It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been a trying year for the Allegheny County District Attorney's Office, bringing lengthy grand jury reports, even charges against one East Pittsburgh police officer. The district attorney is the chief law enforcement officer of Allegheny County, and the office works with about 100 police departments in the county. Teron Jenkins has been a criminal defense attorney in private practice. He served as a public defender for several years and now wants to be the chief law enforcement officer. He's running for district attorney. Teron Jenkins, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
So earlier in your legal career, you spent a couple years in the DA's office, but for the last many years, you've been sort of, you might say, on the other side, defending clients. So why do you want to make the switch?
Like you said, I began my career as an assistant district attorney. And while I was in that role, I began to realize and appreciate the power of the prosecutor. While you had the power and the authority to dictate outcomes for the lives of other people. And I took that role very seriously. And while I was in private practice and as a public defender, actually representing people and defending their rights, I realized just how unjust the system was. And I realized that the only way you can effectuate actual change is through the district attorney's office. So that's why I decided to make this run.
Now, you mentioned power. So when you were in the DA's office, you had power. Do you have
Certainly.
Any power now?
Sir, well, as a criminal defense attorney, you have to essentially fight for everything for your clients. Whereas when you worked in the district attorney's office, you actually had the ability to make decisions. While you have some powers as a defense attorney, the true power position lies with the district attorney.
Mm-hmm. Public defender's office is sort of the antithesis to the district attorney. So what did you learn about public and especially indigent defense that maybe fuel your work on the other side?
Absolutely. I actually began my career as a law clerk in the public defender's office. I was there for a year before going to the district attorney's office. So when I joined the district attorney's office, I came to that office through a different lens because I had already been on the other side. And I've always had a strong sense of doing the right thing and standing up for the right thing and making sure that justice is dispensed to everybody evenly, regardless of their background. So that kind of fueled my desire to want to seek this office because, again, I know that the power that comes with being a district attorney's office, being able to dictate policy, making sure justice is even-handedly dispensed to all the citizens of Allegheny County.
Mm-hmm. So is that a fair characterization, public defender and the DA on opposing sides? I mean, you're at different tables.
They are.
Let's face it, in the
they
courtroom.
Are, but I think at the end of the day, I think everybody should want a right and a fair and a just result. While it is an adversarial process, I think that when you have good people on both sides of the system, I think a lot of the times we can agree on what justice should actually be.
Mm-hmm. So during your legal career to this point, with the caveat that much of it has been from a defense perspective, what has caused you to maybe raise an eyebrow or maybe even voice frustration about the criminal justice system?
If you would have asked me several years ago that question, it would be the same as it is today. I think I share the same philosophy and outlook on how the criminal justice system works. I think my frustration with the system, the criminal justice system, particularly here in Allegheny County, justice is not even-handed. Justice, a lot of the times, it escapes people. I think that as a defense attorney, a lot of the times we just want the right thing to happen. And a lot of the times we have to beg and we have to fight for the right thing to happen. If elected as a district attorney, my primary focus and goal would be for justice to be dispensed evenly to everybody that came through the system.
We've been hearing a lot about criminal justice reform. I mean, just recently in Washington, the Senate overwhelmingly, bipartisanly passed reform legislation intended to make the system fairer, reduce overcrowding in federal prisons. And a couple months ago, Allegheny County received a $2 million grant to help the county continue to build on efforts to reform the local criminal justice system. Why all of a sudden all this attention to criminal justice reform?
That's a great question. I think there are a whole myriad of issues that are just coming to the public. For instance, we're suffering from mass incarceration, people being incarcerated for low-level offenses. A lot of people that are being incarcerated suffer from mental health or drug addiction. And rather than get the people the help and the resources that they need to get their lives put back together, we're shuffling through the system. We're shuffling them through the system and essentially saddling them with convictions and all the collateral consequences that come with that.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think are some of the issues regarding reform that are more easily addressed than others?
Certainly. Right now, the district attorney's office, they engage in what we call overcharging.
And what does that mean?
That means that if someone is accused of a crime, they charge them with everything but the kitchen sink. And they'll charge you maybe with 10 charges, and then they'll offer you to plead guilty to maybe two of the charges. And they have a lot of leverage, because if you go to trial and you lose, you're facing lengthy periods of incarceration. So a lot of the times people plead guilty to things they didn't necessarily do.
Is that their way of speeding up the system, though? Clearing cases.
Certainly. But that's not justice. Mm-hmm. That's not justice. That's justice perverted.
Okay. So overcharging is one. Is there another reform issue that you think is fairly easily addressed?
I think that the DA's office needs to be more proactive in terms of crime prevention and bringing the community together, because right now it's kind of an us versus them mentality between some segments of the community as well as law enforcement. And I believe the district attorney's office should be the front line. They should be the face of linking those two bodies together, because as things proceed the way they are now, they will progressively get worse unless there is a merge. The community and law enforcement has to work together, and that starts with the district attorney's office.
What about bail? If people can't afford bail, doesn't that impact their employment status?
Certainly.
Maybe while they're waiting for the charges to make their progression?
Certainly. A lot of people, they're in jail simply because they don't have the financial resources to make that bail. So you may have two people similarly situated with similar backgrounds, charged with similar offenses. One person has money, the other person does not. So that person that has the resources can get out, while the person that does not sit in jail is essentially a war on poverty. And in this country, we're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. But the way our bail system is constructed, it's anything but that.
Mm-hmm. One criminal justice story that enraged much of the public during the summer was the police shooting death of 17-year-old Antoine Rose in June. The incumbent DA, Mr. Zappala, was criticized for not immediately charging Officer Michael Rosfeld. Was your decision to run based at all on the shooting death of Antoine Rose, or even how the DA's office conducted itself in the investigation?
I don't want to comment too much on the Antoine Rose case for obvious reasons, but what I will say, I actually resigned from the county before the Antoine Rose shooting. It just happened in between my resignation and me actually formally announcing my candidacy for district attorney.
So you've been thinking about it prior
Correct.
To that?
I have been.
Okay. You took some heat early on, not
Certainly.
Long after your announcement, from your association with Bible Chapel Church, an organization that has expressed anti-LGBT views. Where do you stand with them now?
I still attend the Bible Chapel Church. That incident that happened early on, I think that there was a lot of miscommunication and misunderstanding. I have taken steps to reach out to members of the LGBTQ community. I do have people that I'm in close contact with within that community, and we're moving forward. I believe that I'm a champion for all people, regardless of their racial background, whether their religious background, sexual orientation. It doesn't matter to me. I'm here to be a champion for all the people.
You were quoted as saying, quote, "Homosexuality is a sin like adultery." Do you still believe that?
Excuse me?
you were quoted as saying homosexuality is a sin like adultery. Do you still believe that?
What I will say about that, I would like to leave my personal, my religious views out of this race. If we sit and have debates about religion and philosophy, it kind of clouds the issues, and I want to stick to my message.
Okay. You said you reached out. Has there been any response from the LGBT
community? There certainly has been. There have been people within that community that have been active and helpful to my campaign.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you want to keep out any religious views you have. But isn't it a reality that candidates for office, you never know what's going to resonate with the public, whether it's a position on criminal justice reform or making the system more fair to all defendants, anybody who's charged, or something about their own personal beliefs? I mean, isn't that a reality of running for office?
Certainly.
So how do you deal with that?
You just have to separate your personal beliefs and philosophies and remember what you're there for. And you're there for the people, and you're there to be fair.
Mm-hmm. So if you win, what do you want to do?
Where do I begin? I think that we have to begin with training the people that are actually in the office. I think that they need to view the people that come through the system with more of a lens towards humanity and fairness and compassion. Because as things sit right now, it's there's just too much of an emphasis placed on achieving convictions as opposed to actual justice and fairness and how people are actually treated, how we get people the resources to get their lives put back together and moving forward.
Mm-hmm. In our last 30 seconds,
certainly.
So are you saying that maybe it's a change of mindset, attitude?
Absolutely. What? We have to change our approach to the criminal justice system. We have to be smarter on crime, because tough on crime, it hasn't worked. If we just continue to incarcerate people, we're going to continue to spend money and divert resources from education or going back to the community where they belong. I believe that we just need to look at what we're doing and be smarter about it. And go back to treating people like people, because we've gotten away from it, and that's where the focus needs to be. We need to focus on treating people like people.
Teron Jenkins is a criminal defense attorney, former public defender, and a candidate for Allegheny County District Attorney. Teron, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Hello, this is a big hi and a sincere Merry Christmas from yours truly, Ringo Starr.
For seven glorious years, beginning in 1963, the Beatles delighted their fan club members with special holiday records sent out just before Christmas. These limited edition flexi discs contained all sorts of fun messages, skits, and original songs.
Happy New Year, Happy Christmas.
The sixth in the series, the Beatles' 1968 Christmas record, was issued on this day 50 years ago and included a notable rendition of Nowhere Man by Tiny Tim and the McCartney original, Happy Christmas, Happy New Year. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Tim Miller is a Pittsburgh-based poet with an abiding interest in human prehistory. It's an interest reflected in his new collection, Bone Antler Stone. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll asked Miller how he'd describe the book.
I would describe it as a journey through prehistoric Europe, from the Ice Age caves, painted caves of France and Spain, all the way up to the earliest contact with Greece and Rome in the last centuries BC. And it covers as much culture, religion, art, architecture as I could possibly put into the poems.
Let's illustrate that with a reading from the book, the poem Ivita Girl.
Yes. This is a poem about a woman whose remains were found in an island off the coast of Sweden, and she lived about 6,000 years ago, and this is a poem about her. She was 20 years old, and the garment she wore is gone, except for a fringe of teeth, seal teeth, fox teeth, and the teeth of a dog. The hedgehog covered her. Its spiked skin capped her head, and around her neck there hung some 5 clattering jaws she kept close in a bag. And at 20, already middle-aged, did she have some love who thrilled to hear the rattle of her skirt as she slowly came near, or the fall of her cap to finger her young hair?
How did you do your research? It sounds like you not only did reading, but you also saw a lot of these artifacts that inspired the poems in the book.
I wasn't able to see the artifacts until 5 or 6 years after I started reading about them, when my wife and I visited England a few times, and we got to see Stonehenge in person, which was pretty thrilling. But the most thrilling thing of all for me, and which is the last quarter of the book, was going to Orkney in the far north of Scotland, where they have the oldest stone circles, the oldest graves, and one of the oldest, probably the oldest European village, Scarabray, and to just see their huts, to see where they see their shelves, to see the place where they stored their fish, to see the place where they set their fires, to see the place where they put their bedding down, and to know, even though they're not there anymore, to know also that the roofs of these homes were raftered with the ribs of whales. So it's kind of hard for me not to be completely inspired by an experience like that.
What do you think, for readers, the relevance of this material might be? You know, what can we learn from, you know, these artifacts, thinking about the ways of life that people had in human prehistory?
Well, we can see from their burials the things that they valued by the things that they left in the ground, things that took them hours and hours, thousands of hours to make, that they chose to put in the ground. We can learn by their homes, by fortifications that were destroyed, evidence of violence, warfare. We can learn by their ritual objects, that they had reverence for the divine, and a basic reverence as well for the natural world. I think if you took what I just said and removed the fact that we're talking about prehistoric people, I don't think that there's really much difference at all. You can really recognize yourself pretty easily if you allow yourself to, I think.
That was 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll talking to Tim Miller about his new poetry collection, Bone Antler Stone. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. On this month's episode of Still Working, 90.5 WESA's series about work, we hear from 4 people involved in the gig economy. A warning for our audience. In addition to an adjunct professor and a magician, this story features an exotic dancer and details about Santa Claus when he's off the clock. So if you're listening with children, it might be best to wait until you're near some headphones and listen to the full episode in its podcast version at wesa.fm/stillworking.
I think I was initially really stripped. I was like, this is painting and it's serious. And then it occurred to me that, you know, half of my students are just trying to get that humanities credit in. The bottom line is that it gives us pleasure and we lose ourselves in it. So I'm Jenny K. Snyder and I teach fine arts at Community College of Allegheny County. And I'm an artist and designer.
It's under my arm? It's not underneath my arm. Oh, this side?
Well, I call myself a family entertainer. I perform for a lot of kids. My name's Al Hastings, and I'm Pittsburgh magician Al Amazing.
I always liked being a performer. I was always kind of a... when I was little, my mom asked me if I wanted to go into dance class, and my response to her verbatim was, no one's going to tell me how to dance. I'm going to dance the way I want to. Hello. You can call me Iris. I am 26 years old, and I am a stripper.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Oh, I've always loved Christmas. I mean, winter's such a long, desolate, cold, lonely, dark time. And Christmas is like the bright lights. It's joy. It's people saying hi to one another. It's the jolly old man in the red suit from the North Pole, your old friend Santa Claus.
I only have two classes right now. My painting class is once a week for 4 hours, and my drawing class is twice a week for 2 hours. So I'm only there, and then I have an office hour. So I'm only there 9 hours a week. I teach them classical drawing, and we only work from life, and we start with still life. They put the still life together. We are going to work with some perspective because they wanted to learn perspective. And then we work with a model.
Yeah, I'm working on here changing too. It so that way she looks not so front-facing, mm-hmm. but a little bit to the side.
And do a quick gesture with that. Don't like, do you know how to
the
do
the students
a quick
work
gesture?
With her in poses and in costume and in draping and like become so very involved in the creative process of posing her and the composition of the piece. So, and before that, we'll spend some days working on things like hair and hands and facial features because they're nervous about that.
All of the contouring and the finite detail. I don't know. I'm still trying to pick that up. Maybe I just don't have the artistic hand to draw cat eyes that can stab you. That's not me. So instead, I like to use extravagant colors. This one's a nice purple. And also it's dark in there too, so you have to use a little bit more of an exaggerative kind of look. Mm-hmm. Once I get to work, brush my teeth, shake out my hair if I have my hair wrapped, and throw on the heels. And generally, I like to get in a little bit earlier. We, as entertainers, pay the house to work. So the time frames that you arrive vary with dollar amount that you owe back to them. So depending on what time I get there, I will, you know, be racing out and just immediately begin the night. Or sometimes you can work your way into it. I don't always try to have a drink. That's not, for me personally, that's not a mandatory part of my process. Caffeine, I need more than, alcohol. Common oversight is you don't just have to be awake at 2-3 o'clock in the morning. You have to be sprightly at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know? Yeah, so, yes. I've been dancing for a long time. For not a long time, but I've been dancing on and off for about 6 years. And I started doing it full time. I'll say, I need to focus for a second. I gotta think about what I'm gonna wear. Hold on, I have to go look at my suitcase.
Santa's house in Market Square opens at 12. So I'll go get a nice lunch somewhere, head to Market Square about 11:30 or so, suit up, you know, walk around, talk to my elves. And it's a job I can't wait to do because there's so much joy and there's so much fun there.
This is Thomas.
Thomas, hi, Thomas.
Is this your very first Christmas?
It is.
Oh, Thomas, you're going to love Christmas. You're going to love all this. This is going to be great.
I actually started out as a nurse. I was a travel nurse with my wife. We traveled all over the country. But I always did magic on the side, and I perform at least 250 times a year. I'm trying to work less, but it's one of those things I'm very fortunate to be working as much as I can. One of the things I do is strolling magic. Strolling magic, for magicians, sometimes it's a derogatory term, meaning hit and run. You show up, you introduce yourself, you break the ice, you show them great magic for 5, 7, 10 minutes, leave and just go into the next group of people.
This is an invisible bunny. You guys ever seen the invisible bunny?
No.
You wouldn't know it's invisible. Here, take one step back. Here, hold on to the bunny, pet the bunny. Don't smash him. Put the bunny back in my hand.
I would say the older people get, the harder they are to entertain. I think kids do not have distractions in life like adults and teenagers. They have that distraction. It's cell phones, jobs, bills. It's harder to bring them into your world, but once you do, it's very rewarding.
I've had to find a shtick that worked for me because I'm mixed race, because my dad's black and my mom's white. And there's just kind of a general quota type thing that certain clubs meet when it comes to women who aren't white in the industry. And, you know, then they're not as concerned with hiring new people. So with all that being said, my shtick that I have discovered, which is just so natural for me, is disco. And older men would just come up and look at me and just be like, I haven't heard this song since I was in college, or I haven't, you know, and it, you know, that was their sexual experimentation. So then I realized, oh, this is going to work for me. And then I started dancing to Marvin Gaye and Barry White. Ooh, and then, oh goodness, I'm trying to think who else, Curtis Mayfield, oh, Donna Summer. Donna Summer is what changed the game.
Alex and Christina really want their disco.
We'll
leave it on disco for a little.
The sounds of the classroom, I can hear them right now. Or, you know, there's usually a lot of happy chatter, and there's always music, and it's usually something up tempo, and there's usually somebody dancing a little bit while they paint. There's a lot of sounds of brushes in jars mixing around, and there's a lot of people just chatting or asking questions. I like the students to bond well because it's important that they feel like they're in a safe place with their work. Because when you're putting yourself out there in a painting or in a drawing, it's a very vulnerable place to be.
The name of the game is to stay original, and the only way to stay original is not to have any outside influences. But with that said, with any art, you can't progress unless you learn from people who are better from you. And it's one of those things, you can't just walk up to a magician and say, hey, how'd you do that trick? You kind of, like anything, build a rapport, and if they like you, they'll talk about it. But most of the time, when it comes down to it, it's not really the tricks, it's the entertainment value. But if somebody really wants to know, and I can tell they're a budding magician, I would let them behind the curtain, metaphorically.
All right, let's get back to your list here, Nathaniel. It says here you want a dry erase marker. Do you have a dry erase board at home?
Yeah. I'd like three more, please.
Oh, three more. I'll see what I can do. I'll talk.
The color code should be brown.
You know, some kids are like on the bubble. Well, I kind of believe last year. I'm not sure if I believe this year because there's kids at school that are telling me there's not a Santa Claus, and maybe you're just wearing a suit, and maybe you're just a nice old man with whiskers, and you can't force a kid to believe anymore. And when they stop believing, it's almost like it's like a loss of innocence.
Because of the schedule is such that adjuncts really have a hard time knowing each other, and as a result, a hard time organizing. Well, I remember hearing about the union. I was in maybe my third year or fourth year at CCAC. It was when my students said, I want to come back to CCAC and teach. And I thought, oh, not under these conditions. I can't. When you're childless, like I am, you think about what are you going to leave the world when you die, what, how will you have improved the world, you know? And it's fine to make pretty things, but that doesn't, in my opinion, that wasn't enough. I wanted to change this situation for the better, for the long term.
As a nurse, I've seen so many things. I've seen unethical things. I've seen scary things. I've seen things I could not talk about. And you kind of develop a personality to where you're not scared of anything. And to be a performer, you need to be fearless.
When I perform at schools, and even way before I say, I need a helper, I'm constantly scanning the audience. And there's kids you pick and kids you don't pick. The kids you don't pick is the one sitting beside the teacher, because they're sitting beside the teacher for a reason. And you don't pick the kid that says, me, pick me, and everybody's pointing to him. That's also a red flag. But I do my show so many times, and I like to live dangerously. Every once in a while, I do pick the kids that you shouldn't pick, just for that challenge and the fun. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work, but it's a learning experience and fun every time I do it. I'm gonna say hi to more people here.
Everybody has a different groove to it. All dancers have a different groove to it. Some people are just very physical, and they are not here to listen to your problems, and they got this gorgeous big old butt, and they're here for you, and that is where it stops. And then some other people are engaged, and that is certainly way more of the emotional energy spent. And I would say it's spent regardless, because you
you still do have to talk to a bunch of different people all night. It is sales, no matter how you want to look at it, you know?
It's very nice. For 6 weeks out of the year, I'm a big rock star, you know? After that, people will cross the street to get away from me. You know, I look like a homeless guy. They don't want to bother with me anymore. But it's nice being a big star for a little bit.
Your little sister will want for Christmas. What do you want for Christmas, sweetie?
She may want a baby doll.
A baby doll? You're a good big sister. Did you know that? Oh, you worry about your little sister here. That's so nice. Have you both been good this year?
Yeah.
Oh, look at that. She's holding your
hand. Technically, there are no naughty kids. They're all good kids. Some of the parents, they try to threaten the kids with, oh, your Santa's going to put you on a naughty list, and that kind of worries them. I'm not sure if that's a good psychology to use with kids, but some kids will even ask me, am I on a nice list? I said, well, yeah, you're on a nice list right now, but you need to stay on a nice list. You need to work on it. You know, you need to listen, and you need to do your chores, and you know, do your homework and things that you're supposed to do, but sure, right now you're on a nice list.
In the relationship that I have with customers, I don't always feel like I have control. Sometimes they are just drunk and horny and out of control. And in situations like that, sometimes I hit them, and that's the most effective disciplinary action that I can take. Also, sometimes hitting them saves me, you know, and that's that. But most of the time, I think that I can hurt their feelings enough. I've been assaulted in champagne rooms before. And one time I was assaulted in a champagne room, and I remember looking at this man and crying, and I do not like to cry at work. I do not like to cry at work. I don't want for them to walk away having seen my tears. But one time he just would not stop, even though I was saying no. I looked at him and just started crying and was like, I can't believe that you are the person in this world who has all this money. And I think saying that made him, at least in a moment, sober up enough to feel guilty. And then I regained control. But, you know, now it's very much so in the news and in media. Do we understand the politics of, you know, men's entitlement, and that I don't think anybody can maintain full control over a man's entitlement.
No travels, no shopping malls, no candy canes, no Santa Claus.
Then you get like the questions from the kids that are like, you know, Santa, could you make me well again? What do you mean? Well, I've been sick for a long time now, and the doctors don't seem to know what's wrong, and, you know, I just want to be well again. You know, I'll think, dear God. Well, you know, my power and my abilities in making sure you have the right kind of toys, but things like what you're talking about is out of my hands. I have no power over things like that. I wish I could heal people. I wish I had that superpower where I could wave my hand over you and just cure you of cancer or cure you of whatever, you know, problems going on with you, but I don't have that ability. But maybe for a few minutes, if I can make you forget that you have an illness or forget that you have a sickness or an infirmity, then at least I could do that much.
We need magic today more than we have ever. There, the state of the world right now where we need metal detectors to go into museums, schools, all the scary things going on in the world, all the things we see on TV, the internet, we just need some wholesome fun time with our friends and family, and I am the person to help fill that need.
Should I do a magic trick for the big people too?
Yeah.
I don't normally do this. I'm gonna try to read somebody's mind.
I just feel like I'm the most myself when I'm teaching. I like who I am. I like, you know, I feel like I see the best in people in my students when I'm teaching.
You have to find that special middle ground of giving and not giving, and there's just, it's very psychological. So I wouldn't encourage everybody to quit their 9-to-5 and just go and run away and be a dancer. There's a lot to it. It's a misconception to assume that anyone is either having the greatest time of their life or they're having the worst time of their life. If you're an accountant, I'm sure not every day is the greatest day of your life, and not every day is the worst day of your life. People do, in general, what it is that they have to do in order to get by.
Coming up on the program, a conversation with the co-creator of Still Working, Kevin C. Brown. That's when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Still Working is a show about how work shapes who we are and how we see the world. Joining me now is a co-creator on the podcast, Kevin C. Brown, who's in from California. Kevin, welcome.
Oh, it's good to be here.
All right. Today, we heard from an artist, adjunct professor, a magician, a stripper, and Santa Claus, gig work. So what's the process for selecting your interviewees?
It's both very easy and very hard to find interviews. Once we come up with a theme, like gig work that we want to find, we go by a number of different strategies to find our interviewees. We may call a union, we may call an employer, we may talk to friends of friends and friends until we snowball into a person that we want to know more about.
Mm-hmm. These interviews we heard, they're pretty intimate. Talk of control, uncertainty. How did that sense of power or even powerlessness play into how you wanted to tell their stories?
You know, we do spend a lot of time with our interviewees and try and make space for them to talk about the things that concern them. And so listeners will know that my voice isn't on the show. And so when we come to writing it, we have to think a lot about how we can get the highs and the lows that each of the people we talk to experience in the course of their work.
Mm-hmm. You and for a long time, your co-creator, Margaret J. Krause, were a part of the gig economy as storytellers. So did you identify with the experiences at all?
Definitely. I mean, in some ways, our own experiences made us want to write a story that focused on gigs of some kind. And I think in particular, the theme of uncertainty, of kind of what's next, or the possibility of not knowing, really is the one that spoke to me most from my experience.
All right, so that uncertainty, is it freeing? Is it independence?
Well,
or is it stressful?
Well, I liked, of all the people we talked to, Al Hastings, our magician, you know, for him, it's freeing. You know, he moved from a career that was full-time and that he kind of wanted to get away from. And, you know, for others, maybe it's a little more stressful, like Jenny, our adjunct professor, who worked to form a union for other adjuncts at her school.
So as you proceed, are you still looking for those interviewees for future episodes?
Yes, absolutely. We're still crafting the second half of the series, which will be airing in January through May. And so we have a number of other themes on tap and a bunch more interviews to do that we're looking forward to.
All right, about 25 seconds. Give us a tease of January. People who make the streets of Pittsburgh what they are?
Yeah, we wanted to write an episode that focused on the work that happens on the streets. So next month, we're going into the sign shop in Allegheny County, the people that make the signs, street signs. We're also talking to a hot dog vendor and a bus operator for the Port Authority.
Kevin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still Working is produced by Margaret J. Krause and Kevin C. Brown with support from the A.W. Mellon Educational and Charitable Trust Fund of the Pittsburgh Foundation. To hear other stories throughout the month, see photos, and subscribe to the iTunes podcast feed, visit wesa.fm/stillworking. And for today, that is the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on our program, it's been a year full of pivotal and impactful news. From court battles over redrawn congressional maps and resulting Democratic gains from the elections, to a shocking grand jury report on clergy abuse, to the public outcry over the police shooting death of an unarmed teenager. Our Year in Review show, that's tomorrow at 9 on The Confluence. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Meg Fair and Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.